Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats. Or the other way to look at it, it's films from the VHS era, basically. We're going to get together, we talk about films from the VHS era, and our film for this episode is definitely from the VHS era. It is The Craft from 1996, and we do indeed have it on VHS. Not really sure I remember where we got it from, but I think it's a former Hollywood Video. Used video.
I'm fairly confident that I'm the one who purchased it.
Yeah.
And at some point in time, whether it was from Hollywood Video or Blockbuster, because it would have been 1996, we would have been in college, so Blockbuster and Hollywood Video still would have been
very real things.
And existing, and you could buy, get films for a deal on VHS at that time.
Though, you think about it now that you say that. The our home video lives back in those days were pretty much all mom and pop stores. Where we were living in rural Western Pennsylvania, there was not a Blockbuster near us, nor a Hollywood Video, nor a Family Video.
No.
It was all mom and pop, including the grocery store in the town where we lived.
Yep.
Videos. But this has a sticker on it that looks like it came from a Hollywood Video. So it might have actually been a Hollywood Video liquidation purchase.
Ugh.
Just kind of sad.
Yeah.
Can't go home again, which actually is maybe a good way of thinking about The Craft, whether or not you can go home again. Film, while popular in its day, just looking at a couple of the reviews, the Rotten Tomatoes score, very lukewarmly received film, but come on, you're a 90s Gen X person. I mean, this movie was like The Crow. You didn't actually watch it. You didn't actually buy the DVD. It was just issued to you. Like, you just, you know, like when you join the service, here's your bedroll, here are your boots, here's your copy of The Crow soundtrack and The Craft on VHS. And you just deal with that.
I was actually going to say the exact same thing. If you were a certain type of Gen X girl, this film was definitely issued to you. And it was like you had to watch it. It does have a huge cult following, though it does have lukewarm reviews. It definitely has a cult following. And it was a part of that kind of, you're right, like The Crow, The Craft, there was these kind of darker, edgier films that actually had really kick-ass soundtracks.
Yes.
And this soundtrack is actually pretty badass.
Pretty good, yeah.
When you look at it. And so it was at that time, there was something happened in the 90s where it was like dark themes and great music when...
Well, you think about it, it's like grunge happened, the alternative nation took over, and Hollywood said, oh, look at that market. How do we make things for all those kids that like threw their Michael Jackson tapes out the instant they heard Smells Like Teen Spirit and got into Nine Inch Nails and all of that? And so it's very much a film for me that is the product of a time and place.
Yeah.
And I think my viewing of it in 2020, which we did actually in our backyard with some friends, yes.
Which our one friend, I believe, mentioned that Fursa Box's character, Nancy, was like the template for any goth chick.
Yes. That was, I mean, that in a weird way, that's the thing about this film. Is that all? Even the main characters literally look like they came just out of Gen X central casting. Like we need Gen X Catholic high school girl who's a little dangerous, and times four, and that's the film. Like,
and they also look like they walked right out of Hot Topic.
Yes, they do look like they walked right out of Hot Topic. Which, yeah, so. I haven't seen this film in 20 years, probably, at least. Probably since that era.
Yeah.
In more than 20 years than it was since that era. I don't know. Where do you want to begin?
So, I mean, it's kind of a, you know, most people probably know the plot. Actually, it was a sleeper hit, right? It was made for 15. I think it made in the 50 to 60 million.
Yeah.
So it was actually a slight sleeper hit. It was written and directed by men. So the new one coming out is actually going to be written and directed by a woman. And so kind of like knowing that, you do see that it is told almost through the lens of a man, right? Of like this is how a goth girl would act. This is how girls get revenge. This is how girls obsess over boys. That kind of part of it is funny to me in viewing it. But, you know, the premise for, you know, a girl moves to a new area. She's enrolled in new school, trying to make friends. And she ends up with this group of girls who people think are witches. And it turns out they actually are. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that's funny, you know, the way you saying that, this is a male girl power film. Male-powered girl power film. Which is, I think, let's face it, as much as I have nostalgia for the period, what a perfect statement for, like, the 90s, where we thought we were progressive. The window had maybe opened a little bit for other ideas, and maybe the world did turn to the left a little bit aesthetically, but there were limits, and there were ways in which maybe rebellion or critique or whatever you want to, or being just critically conscious of the world, there were maybe limits to how that was portrayed. And so, yeah, I think about that with the craft then, the way that maybe are these girls perfect male ideals.
Then. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think, so for me, I've been thinking about it because we actually, it has been a delay in time since we watched it and I've done the podcast. I've actually been thinking about it a lot lately, and that's why I was like, I still want to do the podcast. I still want to talk about it because for me, it's a modern fairy tale, right? Mm-hmm. So this is Little Red Riding Hood, goes into the woods. They told her not to get off the path. She gets off the path and bad things happen. So this for me is the same thing. So it's this modern fairy tale of this girl who goes off the path, meets the witches, gets in trouble, but is redeemed at the end, you know, because she's a good girl. But they are punished, right? They are very much punished for their behavior. But in actually the Me Too movement time, you look at it and you're like, maybe that guy deserved to be in trouble. These girls are actually getting punished for standing up for themselves. And so that's the really, yeah. So for me, like in viewing it again, and I've watched this movie a lot, I'll say it a lot. It's one of those there was a comedian, you know, what's the movie that you leave the shower and it's on and you're sitting in your towel watching that movie. For me, The Craft was that movie for years. And I've watched it multiple times, but it's probably been a good 5 to 10 years since I've actually sat down and watched the film. Because it's actually, for me, it's not like very scary anymore. It's kind of, can be a little hokey.
Yes, it has a lot of tropes.
Witchcraft
is actually, this is the thing Ebert mentioned in his review. You know, witchcraft is millipedes and snakes.
Yeah. Right, no, witchcraft is meant, but I think of, thinking about it and watching it now being older, and like, you know, so let's just go through it. So, you have Bonnie who's burned, and you're never told how she's burned, but her dad's not in the picture, so you have to wonder if she was burned. Oh, it says she was burned from an auto accident. I didn't realize that came up in the movie. Mm-hmm.
I remember that coming up in the movie.
Me neither. So Bonnie was burned. Nancy is living with her alcoholic mom and abusive stepdad. Rochelle is the only black girl at the school. And she's being tortured by this racist swimmer named Laura. And then you have Sarah, who's just joined. And she actually has a boy who lies and says they slept together. And not only that, he says that she's a really bad lay. Yeah. And so each of the girls kind of get their revenge in their own way. But by the end of the film, they're punished for basically standing up for themselves, right?
Well, except for Sarah.
Except for Sarah, who is
the most purest of heart and just happens to be the most powerful witch.
Right, because she's a natural witch. Yeah.
And so there is this weird, like, Mean Girls quality to this, where there is a weird competitiveness, even as they're striking back and standing up for themselves.
Yeah.
There's not really solidarity there.
No, there's not. And I think, well, and it's also kind of interesting because, you know, a man looking at girl dynamics, right? So he's writing this film saying this is how girl friendship dynamics would work. And initially, they're all getting along pretty well. And then, you know, Nancy decides she wants a lot more power she asks for it, she's granted much more power, and she can't handle the power. But if you think about it, it's almost like anything, like, say, the first time, like, she never drank, she started drinking and she got out of control. She started drugs and got out of control. So for me, it's kind of almost like this teenage girl, literally a teenage girl. And, you know, we've all had that friend in our lives who tried something that put them down a path of danger. And this is kind of what happens with Nancy. And they kind of all, like, fall apart instead of, like, coming together. Mm-hmm. And though it's Nancy having more witchcraft powers, it really is more like Nancy just out of control and needs, obviously, help. And a very much damaged person who is damaged from her abusive father, a gruff stepfather, damaged from her alcoholic mom, who gets a taste of power and kind of gets full of that power. And the girls all fall apart from there. And it does become this Mean Girls where they're out to get Sarah because she's the sweet, kind one of the crew.
Which I think speaks to maybe my warm and fuzzy memories of the film a little bit.
Yeah.
In that, you know, that youth culture, that 90s alternateen culture, and I was definitely one of them, was very much also about... And you saw this in 80s films, too, like youth movies also being about exploring the darker parts of childhood and teendom.
Yeah.
And just knowing that your friends' families had secrets.
Yeah.
And what do you do with that? And so that is a very time and place. And it felt at the time that, oh, we're the first ones to do this, or, you know, whatever. Which it certainly was, like, you know, what happened, what was great about pop music of that time is that you were able to explore human emotions and human experiences that weren't just about falling in and out of love.
Yeah.
But there were just other things people could write songs about. And so in some ways, very much the craft, it has this Mean Girls dynamic. It very much does capture that, I think, really well.
Yeah.
You know, when people get into stuff or, you know, people... Yeah, I call it like the Chuck Yeager phase of anything. Or Pippin, basically.
Yeah, it's
Pippin.
That's true.
It's Pippin.
Yeah,
you know, Pippin, he's lost. Nancy. He's trying to find himself. Yeah. There's these temptations. There's these possibilities. And then we just go Chuck Yeager with every single one of them and break the sound barrier because, you know, you can't just have two beers.
Well, Rachel True, who played Rochelle, they actually the character was not supposed to be black or African-American. It was supposed to be another white girl. Mm. And when she was cast, they actually added in that subplot of her being tortured by Laura. And Laura says some pretty horribly racist things to her. And it's pretty, pretty brutal. And she feels like she has no recourse for it, right? Like, who's she really going to go to and say, this girl's treating me this way? And I think that was amazing. Like, the brutality that she was receiving, it was definitely beyond microaggressions.
Yeah,
right?
It was overt racism.
Yeah.
Which happened in
high
school and our college in the 90s.
Yeah. And I think that was like, wow, like, you're like, wow, that was handled, for lack of a better term, it was like, oh my gosh, yes, there would have definitely been people there. And you didn't really see that, right? So it was like when in the 90s and it was the Bonton Nation and it was like people of every color get along. And, you know, it's cool that she's the only black African-American character in the film. It's okay because she's going to have friends and it's going to be great. But actually, it's not. It's not good for her that she's the only person of color in that school. She's being tortured.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Nancy, I mean, to be honest with you, like, my siblings went to a kind of a wealthier private school for a period of time that my family could not afford. They were there on scholarship and work study. And they kind of went through that, too, of being a bit of outcast because they weren't. Our family was not wealthy. We were very much working class family. It just so happened that, you know, three of them were very smart and were able to get into this school. Mm-hmm. And they really felt like, and I know especially for my brother, he really felt like an outcast because he didn't have the wealth. And Nancy doesn't have the wealth. Sarah being the new person. And then,
and
of course,
Nancy's home environment is explosive.
It is.
I think it's explosive. It's abusive.
Yeah.
It's violent. And so, in some ways, it's this double-edged sword, because in some ways it explores that character and that, again, knowing, I, again, thinking about my youth and things that I'm still sort of processing, you know, and still finding out, talking with friends that I've known for 30 years now.
Yeah.
Like, what was your home like?
Yeah.
You know, we kind of had a sense, or I had a sense, but I didn't know and I never asked.
Right.
In a weird way, it's like, it's great that that window is open.
Yeah.
But it also is very trope. It's a very trope-laden film.
Yeah.
And that it's very, oh, okay, this is the stereotype then. Yeah. Oh, she's dangerous because she's messed up because her home's messed up. And right. She's going to be messed up. Which is also, in a weird way, it's like, it's nice that we're having this conversation on a film, on screen. But also, it's a dopey trope.
Yeah.
It's a dopey trope that you'll see a million times again.
Yeah.
You've seen it a million times before at that point, maybe. Or at least I have now, watching it in 2020, and I'm probably going to see it a million times again. Oh, bad home life. They're messed up.
Yeah. They're messed up.
They're damaged. They're... And that's the reason why they're damaged. And they're edgy, that's the motivation for all of their character.
Yeah.
And which is also such a... It's weird, again, the 90s. We talked about stuff, but maybe in not very constructive ways, finally.
Yeah.
And that for people who maybe come from explosive homes, oh, well, you'll just turn out like Nancy or something, which is not great either.
Yeah, no, no.
And it's not a very deep, well-developed character either.
No. Yeah, I mean, that is
The uniforms, this Catholic Scroll Girl uniforms just look like, pleated skirt. Pleated skirt, blouse, we're good. We got it.
Well, you know, being a Catholic school girl myself, actually all the way through college, but being up through high school having to wear those uniforms, that was very true. That felt very true to form, and how much people would try to push that envelope. I don't want you to think less of me, Matt, but one time, because we were all supposed to wear long sleeves all the way down to the wrist, and it was hot, and I rolled them up, and I got demerits for rolling up my
sleeves.
So I don't want you to think less of me. And then one time I was running late, and I did not change out of my gym outfit to catch the bus on time, so I also got demerits for that. So I don't want you guys to think less of me now, but you know, I had a rebellious streak, obviously.
You had problems with authority.
but you know, there was also a part of being a Catholic school girl who didn't necessarily feel like she fit in with the popular crowd. I was, you know, smart, overweight. I didn't feel a part of any particular crowd in any way. So there is a part of me who that film of feeling like the outsider in the Catholic school felt really telling and important to me.
Which, again, was the 90s.
Yeah.
Which was, it was finally, the dorks took over, or the nerds took over. The losers finally won.
Yeah.
And we won for a decade or something.
Yeah. And we got Weezer. We got Weezer.
You got Nirvana, you got Weezer, you got all of that music that was not the happy kids. You know, hair metal was dead. We were never invited to those parties anyway. And now we can explore the dark side or something, you know.
Yeah.
Which some of us are still there 30 years later, you know. And we watched this movie on VHS.
We did. And so I think the interesting thing for me, though, because this is a cult film, the director really didn't really go on to do much else. His other big known film would probably be Threesome, and that's a stretch for people to know Threesome. But it's about a girl who has a boy's name who ends up assigned to a room with two boys, and they end up having a relationship together. That's probably his other well-known film. And then the producer did the Stuart Little series. So it's kind of like this weird... this like weird involvement people. And no one actually, I mean, Nev Campbell is still known just because of the Scream. And there's a new Scream coming out, but beyond Scream and Party of Five, can you really name that many other films that she has done?
Yeah.
There was that one that had like the lesbian undertones, Wild Things, maybe, I think it was called. But Fruza Bach, her career kind of stalled a bit. Like, we just saw her in an independent horror film where she played an aging woman trying to break into a house, the Trespassers, Trespassers films. You know, Rachel True didn't really have much of a career.
Which I think, though, is that more, I think, unfortunately, especially from that era, how Hollywood treated women.
Yeah.
That women had a very... still do have a very short expiration date.
That is true.
Like, there's one middle-aged woman, Kathy Bates, that's it.
Yeah.
Older, you get Meryl Streep. And you're out. And old, I guess, older Judi Dench. And that's it. That's the three we need. Who knows who where Barbara Hershey might be.
Yeah.
Or something. You know, they just disappear, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Which is,
Even, like, because Robin Tooney was supposed to be the next big thing. She's in Empire Records around that same time. But, you know, Breckin Meyer was in it, which is really funny. He did the stoner guy for 90. That was his career in the 90s. He needed a stoner guy or a skateboarder. Breckin Meyer is the person to go to. And then Skeet Ulrich, who actually was in Scream. He played Neve Campbell's boyfriend in Scream. So... Mm-hmm. He and Neve Campbell for two films were about getting him killed, you know.
Nice.
So, yeah, that was that. But it's kind of interesting when you look at it, and I think you're right. I mean, there is an expiration date for female actresses, but it's kind of interesting that the cult film didn't kind of launch them into, or at least one person into kind of the stratosphere.
Which I think, again, too, is like, I don't know. I mean, I think in some ways... The characters are, and again, such a trope-laden film that's so, you know, the uniforms, the look, that witchcraft is about snakes and summoning snakes and spiders at whatever. There's even the Earth Mother witchcraft store owner who's wise beyond and sees all, but they don't know. Rebellious Catholic schoolgirl.
Yeah.
All of those things, you know, even the douchey guys that you just described are, like, literally, it's just they took every teen movie aesthetic and witchcraft movie aesthetic and put it in a blender. And you get the puree that is The Craft.
Well,
I say that having still warm and fuzzy feelings about the film.
Well, they actually had a Wiccan consultant on the film to make sure they...
Really? Yeah, I did not know.
So I remember, like, hearing about this when I... before I even saw the film, that, like, it's so dangerous they actually had an actual witch, like an actual Wiccan, participate and wrote the spells and all that other stuff. So... You know, they were trying to be true to form and respectful of the Wiccans at that time. Though, can we take a moment, though, and talk about this soundtrack? Because I think we need to touch
on this. Yes, let's talk about, which mine is still, it has not arrived from Discogs yet. And actually, according to Discogs, it has not shipped yet. But I, as we were watching the movie in the backyard, pulled out my phone, pulled up Discogs, and was like,
I
don't own this on CD.
There are some amazing 90s artists on this. Space Hog, Elastica, Tripping Daisy, Juliana Hatfield, Matthew Sweet, Letters to Cleo, Our Lady Peace, Heather Nova.
You know, but it was a lot of, like, the lesser
people,
or the people who came after the Bow Wave that was the major label signing frenzy. The best song, perhaps.
We'll ignore that Jewel was on there.
Yeah. Perhaps the best song, though, that was on the film, in the soundtrack, was Love Spit Love, which is the dude from Psychedelic Furs covering the Smiths, which is such a weird, like, to think you were a contemporary of, asked to then, in your 90s life,
It's an amazing cover.
It's a great cover of How Soon Is Now.
Actually, it's probably the one you tend to hear a lot more often than the Smiths version, to be honest. Like, if it's not the Smiths version, it's usually the Love Spit Love version that you're hearing, which it's just, like, an amazing cover. And of course, you know, if you like Charmed, you know that's the theme song to Charmed, How Soon Is Now. And I believe it is the Love Spit Love cover, maybe.
So Snake River Conspiracy covered it, Quicksand covered it, Everclear covered it. There's a lot of covers, but you're right. I think it is the Love Spit Love cover for Charmed.
So this is...
So I think that was the thing, and I think they got that from The Crow. I mean, understanding from The Crow that you could have the crossover. And this was, of course, still back in my day when we still had music. On music television, on cable. You know, just to know that you had that kingmaker, I think that youth culture kingmaker that was MTV, So if you wanted a youth-oriented film, you had to have the banging soundtrack.
Yeah.
Which then would feature, hopefully there would be a video hit, and the video hit would have spliced in, like, band footage spliced in with footage of the movie.
Yeah.
That would just be a 3.5-minute commercial for the film.
Yeah.
It was also the way things back then. When you had... But, I mean, MTV was such a kingmaker, so yes, you would get... Now, you think that was also, that was post-Nirvana, that was even maybe post-grunge at that point.
Yeah.
There wasn't an artist that really, I mean, I guess for us, like, Juliana Hatfield was really important artist for me. In fact, yeah. I just bought a new Juliana Hatfield CD yesterday.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Is somebody I care about. Matthew Sweet, still somebody I care about.
Yeah.
So the people who weren't, like, massive at the time were not on that soundtrack, yeah. Which maybe would have helped the film out even more. But
yeah, but I think if you're in...
It's a solid 90s soundtrack.
It's a solid 90s soundtrack, and if you're into those kind of lesser-known but still amazing bands, it's a pretty damn good soundtrack.
Yeah.
And you see, those names made me so happy. As we were watching, I was like, oh, that's right. That's Juliana Hatfield.
Yeah.
Yay.
And we had somebody we lived with. Some roommate situation we had, somebody had that on CD.
Yeah.
I was shocked to find out that I didn't own the Kraft soundtrack on CD. And I still don't, apparently, even though it should
someday
have gotten here by now.
At some point in time.
Discogs will come through.
You shall be the owner of it at some point in time. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think maybe that's a good thing to talk about. So, sorry, I wanted to get the soundtrack in, but you mentioned it a couple of times that in this film, witchcraft is really snakes and and insects, which comes up multiple times throughout the movie.
You have that? I mean, you even have, I was thinking about in terms of the dopey tropes, the final scene from Beetlejuice where Winona Ryder is flying through the air in the Catholic schoolgirl uniform. Yeah. There is a... But they got the three witches floating in the air in their Catholic schoolgirl uniform, looking like just visual rhyming of the end of Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, you got that in there too.
Yeah. 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 And of course it is, you know... Slicked back hair, black, jet black, slick back hair, black hair.
Eyeliner.
Heavy eyeliner. Lots of crosses, though, because you are in Catholic school. Lots of calling the you know, watchtowers. Lots of calling of the watchtowers of the south and east and west.
Yes, a lot of ritual happening. A lot of ritual.
And actually, which is... kind of interesting is there is a blood one, which is kind of initially shocked me because that was also like kind of the times when a lot of AIDS awareness was happening.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting that they drank each other's blood, which was like a little shocking. So maybe they wanted that shock of like mixing blood together with it. And there was kind of in thought like hinting at animal sacrifice. They didn't kill the animals, but they brought them with them to do a specific scene.
Yeah.
And of course there's the walking on water scene.
Yes.
That happens. And lots of clouds.
Yes. Clouds and storms and lightning and the forces of nature. And well, which I think again, you know,
and you remember that cherub poster that every college girl had to have in their college dorm? That actually makes appearance there. You know, there's lots of pictures of angels and things like that.
So 90s.
So 90s. Very, very 90s.
Which does that then bring us to the big five questions? And absolutely. The first one being then, is it camp, retro, classic, or just an old movie?
So I'm going to say for me, it's campy. I think there's definitely elements of camp to it. I do appreciate a lot of the themes, but when you look at, I think of the things of like the special effects, the way they dress, the way they act, in many ways, there's things that bridge that feel campy to me about it.
Yeah, which I think begs the question, because again, we're both Gen Xers. We were both born in the late 1970s. We both came of age with grunge and all of that.
Yeah.
Our teen years were in the 90s. I wonder what it would be like, again, older people seeing this film probably not getting the signs and things. Younger people than us seeing this film also probably be like, what the hell is that? Like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, are these the goth kids from that South Park episode? Like, what?
No, exactly. This? Exactly. You know?
And so I think Gen X generational narcissism. That's the only. Is that the only reason to see this movie? Is Gen X generational narcissism?
No, it absolutely is. I think your college students today would probably make fun of this movie.
Oh yeah, I mean it's like the Coppola Dracula. Yeah, when they want they picked it. I didn't shove my culture down their neck. It's not not an aging boomer being like, no, the Doors really are the greatest band of all time. You know, not that move. And actually, I don't think Gen X nearly has the cultural power to make that move. But, because there's just so many more people younger than us. But yeah, I would say, yeah, it's campy retro, but it's just Gen X generational narcissism. And I enjoyed it. And like I said, I ordered the soundtrack off Discogs.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if it wasn't for COVID, I'd be at, you know, the music exchange. Like, I would have taken 15 minutes and driven to Squirrel Hill and grabbed that CD off the shelf immediately as soon as I was done work on Friday. But, you know, COVID time, so the internet. But
so there is definitely elements to me that are dated and funny and cheesy in this film, but I still adore this movie. And
it's generational narcissism. Yeah. If you are under the age of 35, don't watch this film. And if you're probably over 50, don't watch this film. Just don't. Yeah. Don't waste your time. You're not going to get it. You're not going to like it. I mean, but if you have warm and fuzzy memories of the magical era, it was...
Yeah.
Though, then again, my students like Friends for some stupid-ass reason. Like, my students, like, when I taught creative writing, I had students who turned in Friends fan fiction.
You know what,
so there are some things that they do identify with because it was a simpler time. You know, pre-9/11 America where, I mean, and that's the thing. My students this year, they were born in 2002. They have no idea what America was like before it completely lost its mind.
Yeah, but I think there is also...
They never lived in that country.
No, I agree. But I also think, like, I watch Jeffersons all the time and I Dream of Jeannie all the time just because
Because that's all you had, though. But I think the young people today...
But their parents are probably watching
their
Friends.
Their parents
are
probably watching it, but I think... Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. They
but
have
also, like,
enough cultural power and enough things that they can get into and enough making their own content in a lot of cases that they really genuinely... I mean, I...
But my point is, when they were 10, when they didn't have control of the remote or YouTube, their parents were probably watching reruns of Friends during dinner.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. You know what I mean?
And maybe that's how that appealed. Yeah. But, so I think something that The Craft might be too far off the map.
Yeah.
Or they just don't care. I mean, you think I have, whenever I ask, I bring it up, you know, the majority of my classes have never seen Star Wars.
Right.
Yeah. And it's been that way for years, and they don't care.
Yeah.
And good for them, actually. Yeah. So they can have their own mythology, and it's fine. And we have ours, and The Craft is in it. And I should mention, at some point, we're going to have to do it. I magically, and I think because of the podcast, if you follow us on Instagram, you saw this. Somebody gifted us a milk crate with some really choice Laserdiscs in it. And so we're going to have to do The Crow at some point. Because somehow we don't own The Crow on VHS. Now we own it on Laserdisc. And so we have to do it.
We have to do it. Absolutely.
All right. So I think then the other thing is we touched on this briefly about the question too. What about the social political distance of the film?
Yeah. I think, you know, the one big problematic thing for me was the Sarah Chris situation. Because, you know, Chris does... ask her out on her date. She agrees to go. He then lies to people and says that she slept with him because he has a reputation to maintain. And I think that's a very real thing that happened to many girls. But then she becomes really obsessed with him and uses like her power to get him to fall in love with her. And for me, that kind of is always, that part has always, even in the 90s, felt problematic to me. Like, if a guy is treating you this way and making up lies around you, why would you then want to
cast
the love spell and want to be in a relationship with him? And then he gets to the point where he gets up so obsessed with her, he tries to rape her. And you know, and that's, it's very scary. It's very terrifying. But I think for me, I understand they wanted to show the 3x3 principle that if you cast the spell, it could come back to you 3 times worse. So she cast the spell, it came back to her 3 times worse. That one, it was always problematic to me. But, like, also, her friends, who at that time she is starting to fall apart with them, and she's on the out because she doesn't like who they become now that they have all this power, she goes to them, tells them what happens, and they actually act, right? Like, they actually decide to do something. Now, it ends up in him dying.
Yeah.
But Nancy actually does something around it. And so I think in the area of Me Too, of like having your friends who, even though you're falling out with them at that moment, still believe you and are like, we have to do something. That part I think is like powerful, but the part of her kind of like, I still want this guy, even though he spread all these rumors about me. That always felt weird to me because she's supposed to be this really powerful character. She's a natural witch. Yeah,
she could have just cursed him. She could have just made him impotent or something.
Yeah, yeah. You know? She's supposed to be the most powerful witch. She's a natural witch.
Yeah.
And but
she can do witch stuff without even knowing it.
Without even knowing it. She even has powers without having to cast.
Yeah.
The girls have been casting spells that haven't been working, but once she joins them, everything that they cast happens because of her power, right? That, for me, always kind of felt weird.
Yeah.
Now, the thing I did appreciate, though, I keep saying it was written from a male perspective, the toxic relationship that can happen between girls is a real thing. And I think, you know, for men, well, I'm going to speak from men, but I think there is that trope of sometimes guys, it's just like, you kind of get into a fight and sometimes you can kind of move on for it, where for sometimes with a girl dynamic, it can be very catty, right? And there can be this viciousness that happens, and that definitely happens. It does go to an extreme. Jennifer's Body, if you've never seen it, I think does also a fantastic job of exploring toxic female relationships. And this does explore that a little bit. This toxicity that can exist, and I think it handles that really well. Now, the girls talk about other things. Of course, Sarah ends up talking about Chris a lot, but they actually do talk about other things, right? Of like kind of what's happening to them, their hopes and dreams. So that's kind of nice that it isn't all about the boy and getting the boy. There are actually other conversations that are happening as well.
Yeah, and so question 3 is, what about that technical aesthetic? Technical slash aesthetic distance.
Yeah, I mean, I think the special effects are a little dated now.
I think the special effects are dated. It's very 90s. It's 90s fashion, 90s hair. The cool car is very 90s. The music is very 90s, which is why I love it.
Yeah.
But it's time travel at this point.
And,
you know, and they don't have cell phones.
They don't have cell phones.
All landlines, baby.
It's all landlines.
All landlines, no internet.
You can't Google.
They have to go to a bookstore and get a book.
Yep.
To find out things. There are books, these things called. And so that's kind of fun, which I think is part of, actually, not to loop back to this, but the whole Friends thing, I think. Once read an article that explained, you know, it's this idea, it's like, it's their lives and what they want their lives to be, but without cell phones and out the internet.
Yeah.
And what if we just didn't have the smartphone and we could just live our lives?
Yeah.
Which I kind of miss too sometimes.
Yeah.
You know?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, we'll see with the new version, but if it was made now, Chris would have posted all over Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, there has to be some sort of cyberbullying social media thing that happens.
Yeah.
There has to be pics.
That would definitely have happened.
Yes.
The one thing, though, I don't know if you noticed, but she's wearing a wig the whole time, Robin Tooney, Sarah, because for Empire Records, she had gotten her head shaved. She had a buzz cut for it, and she was filming at that around the same time. So there's times where you're like, that is a really bad wig. Like, there's definitely these moments.
Which is maybe question 4, the one place where they don't pass the room test.
Is definitely that. Like, you're very aware that she is wearing wig at certain times in the film. And I think so they cast a glamour spell and she changes her hair color, and it's very evident it's a wig, but also the special effects from that are so bad. Yeah. It is so bad. for it. But yeah, that feels, those a couple things feel very, very dated.
So then question five, is it a keeper?
Oh, well, I think we already answered that question. Yeah. There is generational narcissism here. We adore this film, and this definitely stays in our collection. It's not going anywhere.
Yeah. I might not watch it again for another decade, so we'll see when, you know, the VHS tape is 35, 45 years old, what it'll look like. 35 years old maybe will be the next time we'll watch it.
We do keep it in a cool basement, so hopefully...
Yeah, so it does stay in a cool, dark place.
Yeah, so hopefully...
And relatively low moisture.
Yeah.
When you have a vapor lock.
Yeah.
And...
So hopefully it'll
be... Dehumidifier running down there. So hopefully it'll be fine and we can enjoy it again in the 2030s.
Some people have wine cellars. We have a VHS cellar.
We do. We do indeed.
I don't know what that says about us as people.
That we don't drink a lot of wine, I think is what it is. But we do have a lot of VHS. Oh, that's right. I should do that, actually, for folks who want to follow us on Instagram. At some point, I will do a shelf scan.
Yeah.
So that you can see
the collection.
Yes, cold, dark, but climate-controlled, humidity-controlled environment where the VHS tapes are.
Yeah.
You go, oh, you know.
But this is a keeper.
This is a keeper. The 90s are forever.
Absolutely.
And on that happy note, we're done.
Thanks.
Bye.